The following paid program does not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its staff, or iHeartMedia. Welcome to the Foreclosure Hour, broadcasting weekly each Sunday at 3 p.m. Hawaii Standard Time from the Dubin Law Offices at Harbor Court in downtown Honolulu on News Radio 830 KHVH, KHVHradio.com, and on the iHeartRadio app across the nation and beyond. Here's Gary.
Welcome, everyone. Another edition of the Foreclosure Hour. As usual, we have a very special show for you today. As you know, last week we started to do some case studies. We talked about assignment fraud in the foreclosure context, and we analyzed Bayview versus Gabor, a case in the Fifth Circuit Court on the island of Kauai in Hawaii, civil number 11-1-0179. It started out pro se. There was no opposition to summary judgment. And just before confirmation, my law firm was retained. And the court confirmed the sale, but it hasn't been entered yet. And we had an opportunity last Tuesday, as I alerted you, to have a hearing before the Honorable Judge Kathleen Watanabe. And she paid very, very close attention to the arguments of counsel. We had about 45 minutes, which was unusual, to present our arguments. I think you'll be very surprised. I'm going to play for you now the hearing that took place last Tuesday. And not many get a chance to know really what goes on in the trial court. We're used to just seeing published appellate decisions that don't really many times reveal what actually happened in the case or in the lower court, but just what the judge concluded and wrote in the in his judgment or her judgment. So here we go. We're going to play the tape in its entirety, and I'll have a few minutes left to comment and add a very surprising development in the case. Okay, let's play the tape.
This court is back in session. The Honorable Judge Kathleen N.A. Watanabe presiding. Thank you. You may be seated.
Civil number 11-1-179, Bayview Loan Servicing LLC versus Michael S. Gabor. Defendant Michael S. Gabor's HRCP Rule 60B motion to set aside and vacate based upon fraud on this court. This court's October 23, 2013, 1, findings of fact, conclusions of law. Order granting plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, interlocutory decree of foreclosure against all parties, and 2, judgment as void.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good morning, Your Honor. Gary Dubin representing the defendant, Michael Gabor.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Lance Lee on behalf of plaintiff.
Good afternoon. The court has read your respective pleadings. Mr. Dubin, this is your motion, so you may proceed to make statements.
thank you, Your Honor. I'll just try to be as brief as possible. There's a probably the most basic principle of contract law is that when someone is seeking to collect on a debt, they have to prove that they own the debt. And in the foreclosure field, as Your Honor knows, that translates into principles of standing and jurisdiction. And in the case before Your Honor today, also fraud on the court. Now, this motion is designed to have the court set aside its findings of fact, conclusions of law, and the judgment. And it's in the context, Your Honor, of already admissions by the major banks, especially Chase, that they've been sloppy in their foreclosure procedures. They've even admitted to the AGs and the famous AG settlement a couple of years ago that they've submitted false documents to the court, to many courts, signed by what have been called robo-signers, people without evidence of the actual debt, and that's resulted in approximately $220 billion in fines by the banks, including Chase. But when it comes down to our court system and our lower courts, The lower courts, as Your Honor knows, have been reluctant to enforce what we normally would think are the basic rules of evidence, that people are required to have personal knowledge when they submit documents, etc. Now, this case is a typical example of that. And before I just briefly summarize the basis for our motion, I'd like to point out that the opposition can be disregarded because, first of all, it says, well, there was a clerk's default. However, the judgment we're trying to set aside was not a default judgment. It was a summary judgment on the merits. And a lender has that choice. They could have gone for a default judgment, but instead they went for a decision on the merits. And that's a strategic decision because a default judgment you can open up easily within 1 year with a reasonable amount of evidence. And the Intermediate Court of Appeals, starting in the Bartolome, famous Bartolome case, which was a Rule 60B case, pointed out the distinction between a default judgment and a summary judgment. This was a decision on the merits, and that's why we're seeking to set it aside. The second point in the opposition, Your Honor, is that, well, it's untimely. Well, Your Honor, it's not untimely to argue that there's been fraud on the court. That's been decided by the Hawaii Supreme Court in several cases. I pointed out those in my opposition paper, and actually in my motion papers. So there really is no opposition to this motion on the merits. Now let's look at the merits. Our basic argument is that, as every state that's considered the issue has decided, you have to own the note or the debt when the summary judgment, well, let me go even easier, when the case is filed, when the foreclosure case is filed. And our position is that Chase never owned the note, even today, but especially when the case was filed. And the reason for that is easy. As I go through just basically the points in the paper, first of all, the lender was WAMU F.A. I've given the court proof that WAMU F.A. ceased to exist on January 1st, 2005. The note in this case was signed on November the 27th, 2007, almost 3 years later. Now, that's important because you can't file something at the Bureau of Conveyances if you don't exist. But as I pointed out in the memo for the support of the motion, WAMU F.A. was being used as a DBA for Washington Mutual Bank, which it had merged into, because Washington Mutual Bank didn't want to go about the trouble of getting a license in every state in the United States for a mortgage broker. So they used Washington Mutual F.A. as a mortgage broker. Well, the Kita case in Hawaii and the Hawaii Supreme Court pointed out that if you're not licensed as a lender, you obviously cannot conduct business in Hawaii. But it gets worse than that for Chase, because then the Federal Deposit Insurance Company takes over Washington Mutual Bank. And we have testimony in other cases, which I've given to Your Honor in our exhibits, where the very receiver in charge, Mr. Shoup, for Washington Mutual Bank, has testified, as well as other employees of Washington Mutual Bank and the FDIC, which I've given Your Honor, that when Washington Mutual Bank went into receivership on September 25th, 2008, they didn't even know what Washington Mutual Bank owned by way of mortgages. There was no inventory taken. The truth of the matter was that there's evidence in the record and pretty well acknowledged that almost all of Washington Mutual Bank's mortgages were securitized, starting, you know, as early as 2003. So they didn't know what mortgages Washington Mutual Bank owned. Nevertheless, they signed an agreement called the purchase and assumption agreement with Chase in September 2008, saying that they gave all the mortgages to Chase, but nobody knew what that was. Then, of course, along comes some federal courts, and they said, well, you can't foreclose based upon the purchase and assumption agreement. You've got to have mortgage assignments. So then, like in this case, the FDIC on December 24, 2009, assigned, supposedly, the Gabor mortgage loan to Chase. And what makes it more interesting is that Mr. Gabor, I'll make this offer of proof to Your Honor, as he went through the loan modification process, he found out that Freddie Mac actually owned the mortgage because they kept referring him to Freddie Mac. And in fact, I went on the Freddie Mac lookup, and in opposition to the proposed confirmation order, Your Honor, I gave Your Honor a copy of what I found on the Freddie Mac lookup, where I put in Michael Gabor, street address, Social Security number, and on the official Freddie Mac website, it says, yes, our records show that Freddie Mac owns your mortgage and your note. So there's a real issue here as to who actually owned the Gabor mortgage at the time that the foreclosure was filed. And who actually owned the Gabor mortgage at the time that the FDIC took over the receivership? So that now suddenly, August 21st, 2014, Chase transfers the mortgage to Bayview. And Bayview proceeds to confirm the sale. However, if Chase didn't own the mortgage, then Bayview took nothing. And then we found out, Your Honor, just recently, my client received a 1099A on his property by the lender. The lender on this official IRS form says the lender is Freddie Mac. And I apologize, Your Honor, I just got this recently. If Your Honor wanted to see it, I could.
Mr. Dios, you don't see that.
Thank you. I'm showing it to opposing counsel. So, Your Honor, to conclude, I believe there's enough evidence in this record to show that Chase did not own the Gabor mortgage. And I think that not only setting aside the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment based upon the erroneous assumption that it did, would be enough. I think the case should be dismissed. Alternatively, what I'm asking for, Your Honor, is let me take the depositions of these people who have been not only in this courtroom, this is not unusual, in every courtroom in this state for years have been submitting these false documents. Let me take the depositions, give me an evidentiary hearing. And I believe I can show Your Honor the fraud involved, the fraud in the declaration of indebtedness, the fraud in the attorney's affirmation, the fraud in the attempt to confirm the sale. And I want to point out, Your Honor, that this sale originally was confirmed, I think, $189,000. And Your Honor was told that was a reasonable and just price. And after we objected to that price, they raised it to $345,000. And by coincidence, before that, Freddie Mac had told the United States government in the IRS form $355,000. So they play around also with the bidding. The bidding, which is rigged because of their credit bid, which in this case could have been like $700,000-$800,000. So nobody else bids. So they bid $189,000, I believe. They could have bid $3 and nobody would have bid against them. So now they raised it. But that's another issue, because we don't feel $355,000 itself is satisfactory. This whole case, Your Honor, smells of fraud. From the time the complaint was filed to the representations that were made, Your Honor, right down to the auction. And the confirmation order has fortunately not been signed. I can tell Your Honor, on behalf of every homeowner in this state, I would welcome the chance in this courtroom, in this case, to prove in an evidentiary hearing the kind of fraud that's been going on in every courtroom in this state, in my experience, for at least the last 7 years. And I go back finally to where I started. It's a basic principle of contract law. You can't collect on a debt if you don't own the debt. And if we apply the laws of the law of contracts, we apply the rules of evidence, this entire case, Your Honor, is a sham. I've even looked at the declaration of indebtedness. It isn't even based on first-hand information. It's based on somebody saying that the records are correct, but they had nothing to do with WAMU, FA, or WAMU, FSB. Now, I acknowledge, Your Honor, that my client did not have an attorney when he lost the summary judgment. He didn't even present a defense. And, of course, that complicates the judicial process when people do not advocate correctly their case. But I can tell Your Honor that it's very hard to find a lawyer, not only in Hawaii, but throughout the United States, who understands these issues. It takes a long time to understand these issues. I remember 5-7 years ago, I had no idea what MERS was. I saw these big names, J.P. Morgan Chase as trustee for blip-blip pass-through certificates. I didn't know what that was all about. It takes a long time to understand these things. Our educational system, in this sense, was not prepared for the secondary mortgage market cases. Our judges, who come from the legal profession, were not prepared either. So I asked the court not to hold that against my client, that he was unable to find a lawyer who understood this area. It's not easy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dubin. Is it Mr. Liu?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Liu, before you respond to Mr. Dubin, the first question I have for you is, do you have possession of the original note?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have it with you in the
courtroom?
Yes, right
here. Okay.
May I see that, please?
Yes.
Well, can I see it also now?
Yes.
Thank you.
Jill, would you please return this to Mr. Lee? Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
And Mr. Dubin, do you want this 1099A back?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Chair. Thank you. All right, Mr. Beal.
So, Your Honor, we request that any response into our opposition be stricken because there was no reply filed, so it is prejudicial to our client to have to, you know, properly brief those issues at this time. But we have nothing further other than our opposition we submitted, and we have also brought the original note showing that the holder of the note is entitled to enforce the mortgage.
Any comments regarding the default that was taken against Mr. Gabor and that was not set aside?
Your Honor, yes. It, as we put in our opposition, default was entered on October 6, 2011. That's like 4 years ago. And they could have argued this fraud previously, but only now they're bringing this issue to the court.
Anything further? I know you rely on the BDM case. Anything further?
We have nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I'd like to address the issue of the note. First time I've seen it. About 9 years ago, borrowers used to argue, show me the note. And that became a famous issue. And the courts held, you don't have to see the note. You got the mortgage. But because of all the problems in the falsification, the problems of the assignments of the mortgage, now the lenders are saying, oh, we'll show you the note. Reverse of what they did. Now, let me point out that that note is endorsed by Ms. Riley. Ms. Riley was head of the securitization department. She securitized all the notes. So the fact that that note has her endorsement, her deposition is all over the Internet. I would have brought her deposition, for Your Honor, in cases on the mainland if I had known, if I'd seen the note. But
okay, well, Mr. Dubin, Mr. Leo made it clear that he was bringing the note to court today.
Well, like I say, that proves that the note was securitized by her signature. Secondly, there's been a lot of showings in cases on the mainland that notes have been falsified. The Bank of America, for example, has had 4 manufacturing plants, notoriously producing Alanges and notes. In one case on the mainland, they found that on the signature line, the black line was on top of the signature, which had been photocopied. Now, I have an expert who examines the notes. I'm not an expert in examining original notes. I'm sure Your Honor is not as well. One of the things I'd like to do is to have my expert examine that note. So, this is the new tactic of the lender. They come to court with the note, as if any of us are experts on the note. But let me point out something additional. The old assumption was that the mortgage follows the note. So if you had the note, you're entitled to the mortgage. However, there's an exception to that. If somebody sells the mortgage as security for another debt, the note follows the mortgage because somebody, like in the secondary mortgage market, investors have put money in with the security being the mortgage. They have an equitable right to control the note. In that case, the note follows the mortgage. So when one shows one the note, in a secondary mortgage context, it doesn't mean that one has the right to the debt or even the right to foreclose, because that right is a right that the holder of the new debt has that has security in the mortgage. And that's an issue that's also overlooked. So in this case, somebody owns the mortgage. Whoever owns the mortgage controls the note. It doesn't work the other way. So when they walk into court and say, here's the note, it doesn't really conceptually mean that they have a right to foreclose, even if it were the original note. Because the question is, in the secondary mortgage market, that mortgage was used as security to get money from third parties. Those third parties have the right to foreclose. They have the right to control the note. And that's the issue. And there's another issue here, Your Honor. I make this offer of proof. Mr. Kabor was sent a letter from an insurance company. I have it right here, Genworth. It says, your lender has notified us that you are experiencing hardship. As the mortgage insurance company that is insuring your loan, Genworth Mortgage Insurance may be able to assist you because we are obligated to pay a percentage of any loss incurred by your lender if foreclosure of your property occurs. So you have Mr. Gabor paying an insurance premium for insurance from Genworth to insure against a loss in a foreclosure. And yet they go ahead, Your Honor, and they hold an auction and they ask for a deficiency judgment. And not only that, but the investors in a securitized trust also have insurance. So many times these loans are paid. The investors are paid by non-recourse insurance from Radian or AIG.
And Mr. Newman, that's the objection that you made to the proposed order that was submitted by Mr. Neal.
That's correct, Your Honor. So therefore, behind the scenes, all this stuff is going on behind the scenes, and yet they want to double and triple collect. So many times, the loan has actually been paid in the securitized field, and the servicer walks in and says, and keep in mind, this so-called lender, what's its name? Bayview Loan Servicing. It's a servicer. It comes in and takes the note that's already been paid, and it gets the free house because it has nothing, it has no investment in the property. And it comes into court and says, Your Honor, here's the note. But there's much more involved. Who owns the mortgage? Has the mortgage been paid? The note is controlled by the investors. And there, it even goes deeper than that, Your Honor. These securitized trusts, they take the property of the borrower and the earning power and they turn it into a stock. The owner, the borrower is really an issuer of stock. This whole area should be covered by the securities laws, not by the foreclosure laws. But one doesn't have to get into all that complexity. The issue here is that there's documents submitted in this case. There's evidence that they're fraudulent. And I'm asking the court for the opportunity to show the court that that's true. And I'm firmly confident that I can do that. And I think that every judge in this state needs to see that evidence. Thank you very much.
Mr. Newman, one more question before I hear from Mr. Beal. You're bringing this under 60B4, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And you're doing that because this would take it outside of the 1 year
period. That's correct.
And 60B4, well, your arguments today is solely based on fraud committed on the court.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, 60B4 has to do with judgment that's void, So are you saying that because of the fraud that that makes the court issued judgment previously void?
Yes, that issue came up in the Ivanovov case before the California Supreme Court just last month. And they had a pretty good analysis of that, that where it is void, in this case it's also fraud because they represented to the court the validity, which was untrue. That in that case, it's void, as opposed to voidable. Where it's voidable, at least that court ruled that you can't get the benefit of 60b-4. But you can if it's void. And our argument is that if you go back to the Y Supreme Court cases I cited in the memo, and if you look at what Justice Black said in the Atlas Hazeltine case in the United States Supreme Court, there's no statute of limitations when one commits fraud in the court. And it's the attorney affirmation which ties the fraud together with an officer of the court. I mean, otherwise somebody could come into court, present the court with false documents, foreclose on somebody, absolutely false documents, and then would one conclude there's no relief? You can also go on 60b-6, which would be extraordinary circumstances. But we think in this jurisdiction, 60b-4 is what was used in those other cases I cited to say that in this jurisdiction, according to the Y Supreme Court, there is more to be gained by setting aside a fraudulent judgment than maintaining the regularity of the system. And I think I'm saying more than that. I'm saying, give me a chance to prove it, because what I've got is I've got enough that anybody with legal background would conclude this looks awfully suspicious. This wasn't told to the court in the attorney's affirmation. This wasn't told to the court when the summary judgment motion was presented.
Okay, so, Mr. Dubin, your argument, Mr. Liu argues that you have not met the BDM factors, and he's referring to the default that was taken against Mr. Gabor, I think back in October of 2011. But you're saying that the court issued a judgment on the merits.
According to the Intermediate Court Appeals case I cited, the Bartolome case, which was my case, one of my cases, they made the distinction between a default judgment and a summary judgment. And what happened here was the lender decided not to take a default judgment, thereby ignoring the default. And once again, I don't think there's any court that would say, well, there might have been fraud here, but because it was a clerk's default, I'm not going to look at the fraud. I mean, this goes to the integrity of our entire judicial system.
Anything else, Mr. Dubin?
No, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Liu?
Your Honor, any kind of requests made by Mr. Dubin is untimely. I mean, he could have, made these requests well beforehand. Also stated in... Further, in order for, as we put in our opposition, in order for Mr. Gabor to argue fraud, he must prove that the fraud must not have been discoverable by due diligence before or during the proceeding. I think he's had well enough chance to do that, and then we've also entered default, so he can't contest anything regards to liability. So we just request that Your Honor deny this motion because, I mean, the law is pretty clear the holder of the note is entitled to enforce the mortgage, and we have the original note.
And once again, any comments regarding Mr. Dubin's statements on the record regarding the note?
Just that it's untimely, Your Honor. And we've showed the note. I mean, he could have had an opportunity to bring an expert witness to, you know, check the note to see the authenticity of it.
Okay, so when you say it's untimely, you're talking about issues regarding the note itself.
Yes, Your Honor. The fraud, based on the assignment of mortgage that was recorded back on January 5th, 2010, which is what he's claiming.
Okay. What about Mr. Dubin's position that he brought this under 60B4, which doesn't place a time limit?
I'm nothing right now that I can. We can submit a supplemental. I mean, I think this is something that Mr. Dubin could have put in a reply. To throw on us now is kind of unfair.
I thought he did. Okay, so you're saying this reference to 60B4, this is something that you weren't prepared to address.
Hey, Your Honor, we're going under the law that says, you know, because we hold the note that we're entitled to enforce it, because that is essentially what his opposition was about.
Okay. Mr. Dubin made statements on the record regarding a signature on the original note. Did you wish to address that?
So, what is his exact opposition for that with regards to that? Is it
Mr. Dubin, do you wish to restate that on the record?
On the record regarding the signature?
Yes.
Well, I pointed out the Riley signature proves that it was securitized, and the Chase didn't own it. And also that there has been evidence on the mainland of photoshopping of signatures, and that the only thing that I can do, I'm not an expert, and I don't believe Your Honor, I know Your Honor isn't, I know Mr. Liu isn't, I can have my expert examine it. But again, the reality of it is, even if they had the note, the note follows the mortgage, because the mortgage was used as security for another loan to the investors. And the note itself may have been paid off, and it's not clear as to who actually owns the note, because somebody may have the note. One time on the mainland, somebody gave the note to the judge and then said to the judge, you're now the holder of the note. So it's more than just holding the piece of paper. It's a legal issue as to who has the right to the piece of paper.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Can I just point out
Yes.
that Justice Black pretty well handled the issue of timeliness when he said that the institutions of justice cannot be prejudiced by the diligence of the parties. To say that fraud on the court can be waived by untimeliness is showing one doesn't understand the concept of protecting the institutions of justice. Secondly, in regard to Rule 60B, this court has full authority without 60B, sui sponte, to react to fraud on the court. Now, I did address fraud on the court in the opposition papers rather thoroughly. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Liu, as far as notice to you that the argument was being brought under 60B4, mm-hmm. I draw your attention to the motion by Mr. Dubin on the face page. It it says this motion is made pursuant to Rule 1, Rule 7B, and Rule 60B, 4, and 6 of the Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure. So clearly this was laid out. Mr. Leo, as the, do you have any further arguments?
We have nothing further, Your Honor.
And Mr. Dubin, as we move on, you know, any final words?
Only that we would have no objection if Mr. Leo wants to submit a supplemental paper, as long as we have the opportunity to respond.
Okay. And Mr. Leo, are you objecting to the request by Mr. Dubin for additional time to do discovery?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. And how much time would you need for any supplemental pleadings?
Maybe 45 days.
Mr. Dubin, do you have any objection to that?
Well, if you really need 45 days, I think that's kind of long. I was thinking more in terms of a couple of weeks.
I guess that's along the lines that I was thinking as well. Mr. Liu, I'll give you 2 weeks. Today is April 12th. So submit by close of business April 26th. Okay, and then one thing I just want to say on the record. I'll wait to see what's in the supplemental memo. But in the future, counsel, when you come before the court, first of all, Mr. Dubin, don't assume that there's going to be a continuation for additional discovery. You were placed on notice that Mr. Liu was bringing the note in. That's very clear in the pleadings. So come prepared for that. Mr. Liu, also in the future, on a motion as critical as this, don't simply rest on the opposition. Okay. Again, be very mindful of the basis for the motion that's being brought, and come prepared to address this as well. All right, so the court will wait for the supplemental memo and then render its decision in, I would say, a week after receipt.
Thank you. Would the court like me to file a brief response to the supplemental?
I don't think that's necessary, Mr. Dubin. Excuse me. If you wish to state anything more regarding the 60B 4 or 6, then you may do so. But I see the distinction between what you're arguing and what Mr. Leo is arguing.
Right. I think I only if it's something brand new, I might want to comment.
Brand new along that issue?
Well, whatever he's going to have in a supplemental. If it's something we haven't discussed.
Okay. Because the memo should only address the 60B4.
60B4, okay. And when would that be due?
That's it. And that's why the two-week period. And then, Mr. Dubin, the court is denying your request for additional time to conduct more discovery. Okay. All right. Thank you.
And what about my response? If his in 2 weeks...
Do you wish for time to respond to his addressing of the motion on which you brought your motion, the rule on which you brought your motion?
Yes, only if there's something new we haven't discussed.
Okay, then let me give you a deadline for that as well. Okay. As I said, Mr. Leo, you submit your supplemental memo by the 26th of April. Mr. Dubin, assuming that you're going to be served with that shortly thereafter, how much time are you going to need?
Probably 1 week.
Okay. All right, so we'll have you respond by... let's do it May 5th, close of business. And when I say close of business, I'm using 4 p.m. for purposes of filing. And then the court will issue a decision within a week after that.
Okay, and I'm restricted to the 60B4-6 issue.
That's correct.
Right. What if?
And again, it's the basis of your motion. And
right.
That's the reason why I questioned Mr. Deal about that. his arguments were not addressing 60B4.
Is he restricted to that also?
That's all this memo is about.
Okay.
That's the only question that the court has.
All right.
Okay? All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, you've heard the recording of the hearing. And as I said, we don't usually get a chance to present the hearing, at least live as we did, as far as audio is concerned. Let me say, give you a couple of extra comments. First, the shuffling of paper you heard in the background was mainly the judge. The judge was taking the hearing and the arguments very seriously and was continuing to go through the papers as we talked, and her mic was picking up that information. Let me say a couple of things about being a trial judge. The trial judges are restricted by case precedent. So especially in the foreclosure field, when you have so many bad initial appellate decisions, the lower court judge does not have the freedom that the appellate courts do. And the trial court judges like Judge Watanabe, who you heard, they have dozens of cases a week. They have limited staff, and they can only spend a few hours analyzing the papers that have been presented to them. And obviously, they're influenced greatly by the quality of counsel's presentations. And, of course, they've got a tremendous backlog. So when you start talking about going back and setting aside previous decisions, you can understand the reluctance of trial courts to do that. And maybe we ask too much of our trial court judges. For example, in the hearing you heard, these are very complex issues. And with limited staff and dozens of cases a week, I would anticipate that a trial court judge like Judge Watanabe can only spend a couple of hours on the case. With that in mind, we're asking the court to set aside the prior summary judgment based on Rule 60B. 60B comes from the federal system, and most state courts have adopted Rule 60B as a civil rule or pretty much have adopted it in some form. Now, you don't have to go through 60B. If a case is over and you feel there's fraud on the court, you can file an independent action. And we could just as well have filed an independent action on fraud on the court. And a new action gives us discovery automatically and gives us more rights. However, it takes longer. In this case, I was faced with a confirmation coming up, and therefore it was strategically wiser to file to set aside the prior summary judgment based upon 60B. But even if Judge Watanabe were to turn us down in a couple of weeks, we could still file a new lawsuit as independent action. Now, in these kind of cases, when you come back to try to set aside a judgment for a number of reasons, you're faced with a clash between two concepts. One is res judicata, which means that something was already decided, versus fraud on the court, where the courts have held that the integrity of the judicial system requires judgments based on fraud be set aside. Now, you can imagine in the foreclosure field, unlike it seems every other field of law, there's been a reluctance to set aside prior judgments, even for fraud on the court. The arguments that opposing counsel would make is that, oh, you want a second and third bite at the apple. But there's a lot of precedent, you've got to gather it in every jurisdiction, that where there's fraud on the court, you have a right to set it aside. Now, here's an interesting wrinkle. If it's fraud on you, for example, let's say perjury was committed, and the guy later on confesses that he perjured his testimony. In most jurisdictions, they say, well, that's not enough. They don't interpret that as fraud on the court, fraud on you. So this is another difficult area of the law. But nevertheless, how could one argue that if a judgment was procured by fraud, you can't set it aside? Now, I have a surprise for you, because here's another issue that was not before the court, that will be when its supplemental papers are filed. This note of Gabor was dated November 27, 2007. And there's an endorsement on that note by Cynthia Riley as vice president of WAMU FA. But guess what? On November 2006, the year before the note was apparently endorsed, Cynthia Riley was laid off and she was no longer a vice president of WAMU FA. And she's had several depositions taken in various state and federal cases. And she's testified that there were several hundred endorsement stamps placed on notes while she was at WAMU FA. Approximately one every 1.5 minutes while she was there. She had a team that was processing these papers and these endorsements. So what we have is we have a 2007 note endorsed by someone who wasn't the vice president in 2007 on behalf of a lender that wasn't in existence after November 2006. Join us again for another Foreclosure Hour. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Let me know how you think the judge should rule. info@foreclosurehour.com
Countdown is on.
When the circus is over, the American people are going to want to understand who could actually beat that.
The 2016 election happens here.
KHBH Honolulu and iHeartRadio station.